couple things. Number one, the dilation theorem for PODMs, you actually saw in the tutorial, I checked. So you saw the proof. Remember the theorem I gave you that you can understand a coupling of a detector to a system that you want to probe, and then a PVM on the detector. It's a POVM on the system when you update. You've actually done it in the last tutorial. So maybe check, maybe you were doing it without thinking much about it, right? But it's correct, yeah. Irini and I checked, and it was something that you did in the last tutorial. So make sure you review that. Maybe you were doing it without thinking you were proving that, but that's what you were doing. So check it and see if we discuss it, right? Like we can discuss it if you want, if you had an issue, if you don't see exactly that you were proving the statement that was on the board. All right, today we start a new chapter, if you want. We start the chapter related to quantum computing. And we are going to begin with an introduction to classical logic. So probably many of you have seen many of that, but I'm pretty sure that there will be observations here that not everybody are aware of, which are related also with the birth of quantum computing and what came right before quantum computing. So I'm writing here a set of, we call those logical gates, a set of operations on bits, mapping sets of bits to set of bits, and we call them classical gates. So these are very common classical gates. I'm missing some, I'm gonna write now. The NOT gate, everybody knows the NOT gate, I assume, is the negation, right? You have an input and an output, so you have only one channel. Okay, we're gonna write circuits. We're gonna start writing circuits. And circuits are graphic representations of logical circuits. We're gonna do it both for classical and for quantum logic, because quantum circuits use all the conventions of classical logic as well. There's nothing new in that. Well, not quite true. There's nothing new, but the language that we use in circuits is very similar to the language we use in classical logic, okay? So here, the circuit representation of a NOT is like this. So you have here your input. This is how you enter, and it's the same thing. So you want the in and out here, you can call it A and A. You only have one channel, and the channel A is going through a NOT gate, we represent in a circle with this in, right? A circle with a kind of a cross or a plus, if you want. And what it does, of course, is the input is zero, it returns a one. If the input is one, it returns a zero. Make sense? So if you start with a one here, you're gonna get a zero here. Make sense? All right. Now we have the OR gate. OR gate has two inputs and two outputs. So we're gonna say that B is the output, that's the convention typically. You call A the input and the input is untouched, and B the output and D is what gets transformed into what the result of the gate is. Make sense? So you start 0, 0. The OR logic is basically, okay, at least one of them has to be one in order to return a one, otherwise it's a zero. So when both are zero, you get a zero. When at least one of them, of the inputs is a one, you return a one. Make sense?
Yeah.
Everybody? All right, we had AND here, the AND gate. Basically the logic is, well, if one of them, if both of them are a one, then return a one, otherwise it's a zero. Since, I mean, both A and B has to be one in order to get a one. This is, by the way, the product. All right, the operation is the product. AND gate is the product. Make sense? Multiply the two inputs and that gets you the output. All right, we also have the exclusive OR, XOR, also called CNOT. It's way more common to call it CNOT, and as we will see in quantum logic, or the equivalent to that. So that is, what is a control NOT? A control NOT is, what you can tell, a control NOT here is a sum modulo 2. This is the symbol we use. So again, use the symbol for direct sum. Here, it means sum modulo 2, right? So basically, you get 0 plus 0 is 0, 0 plus 1 is 1, 1 plus 0 is 1, and 1 plus 1 is 0, because it's modulo 2. Make sense, everybody? Now, the control NOT is called control NOT, and we have it, we represented a circuit like that, because basically it's saying, all right, do something to the target, but only do it depending on what the control is. If the control is a 0, then do nothing to the target. If the control is a 1, do a NOT to the target. That's another way of thinking about it. See what I mean? So if the control is a 0, so the input A is a 0, then the target is unchanged. If the input is a 0,
then the target is unchanged. You get 1 and 1,
you see?
But if the input is a 1, the target is swapped.
So that's why we call it control NOT. It's a NOT gate, but it's controlled by a control bit. And if that control bit is 0, you do nothing. If the control bit is 1, you flip B. Make sense, everybody? All right. We also have NAND. So NAND here, oh, by the way, this is this one is called exclusive OR, because it's like, well, it's if A or B are 1, then you get a 1. But if both are 1, you get a 0. Or if both are 0, you get a 0. So exclusively OR. All right? OK, so we have the NAND. The NAND gate is telling you that, well, if the input is a 0, if basically is the negated AND. The output is the opposite output that you would get with an AND. That's where you have an N in front of the AND. Make sense? All right, a couple more. We have NOR, which is, again, I'll do the table. In, out, A, B, and A, NOR, A, and A, NOR, B. So it is always the same, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1. And NOR would be 1, 0, 0, 0. So if you see, the NOR gate is the negated OR. It does the opposite as the OR does. Okay? That's why the N in front of the OR. And I'm going to write one more, which is the Toffoli gate. The Toffoli gate is a 3-bit gate. Okay? So I'm going to write it for reasons that we will see in a second. Toffoli gate is also called the doubly controlled NOT. The Toffoli gate, you have 3 bits in, 3 bits out. So let's see how I do that. A, B, and C. And then you get A, B, and Toffoli of the two, that is going to be the following. It's gonna, logically, it's going to be doing C plus A times B. That's the output. So this is out. All right. So let's do this. 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0. 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1. That's all possible inputs. Okay, let me do the table proper here this time. So this is 0, 0. Let me just copy this too. 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1. And here we do, I'm going to do it and I'll check later. All right, so we do A plus B times C. This is a 0, well, I'll write them. 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0. So what I'm doing here, just pick your favorite. What I'm doing is A times B, this is a 0. Plus C, this is a 1, so the result is a 1. Make sense? All right. So, before getting to the more interesting part, let's define the notion of universal set of gates. Okay? So, universal set. Okay. A set of gates is universal if it can be used to build any functions f that goes from C to N to C to M. So f of x1, xn equals some x1 prime, if you want, xm prime. Right, so we want functions that map a set of bits to a set of bits, any function that you can think of, and we call a set of gates universal if we can actually build this function with the set of gates that we have. Applications of many times a set of gates, as many as needed. Okay? Now, it's very easy. This is, some people call it Boolean logic. This is mod 2 math, which means that all the functions that you can have here are made out of like multinomials. So you have sums or products, and that's it. That's all that you can have. Make sense? Any function can be written in terms of sums or direct sum mod 2 and products. So then you get all the multinomials, you can get any function. Make sense, everybody? So clearly, we start from a set, which we said, okay, so the set XOR and is universal. So the set, for example, set XOR and is universal. Why? Well, again, this is products and sums. That's all that we can have to build a function. Make sense? Now, there are other universal sets. For example, I can have, I can have a not. So another example is not an and. Another example is, we will have some fun with that, I hope. Another example is, yeah, NAND in itself. And another example is Toffoli, actually. Toffoli for two. Examples for 2 bits. But then you can escalate. So if it's for 2 bits, you can add more and then add it with a third and do all the functions. So maybe I'll just remove examples for 2 bits. This is easy to see. These ones may not be as easy to see. Let me just show you, for example, that you can have A sum B. It's equal. So for example, we'll do it with a short. So, not from a universal set. I should prove maybe that not an from a universal set.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you? Hello.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay. Hi. Can I ask a question?
Of course.
When we talk about. Okay. When we talk about.
I'm sorry. Can you speak slowly for that? I may have problems understanding you otherwise. Yeah.
Sure. Hi. I don't know how good my.
Go ahead.
When we say that Toffoli forms a universal set, we mean that it can produce any kind of function, and like when we want to.
I'm not understanding it. Sorry. Does anybody understand it? Can parse it for me?
Question about what it means.
I haven't used yet.
I'm gonna actually prove that they're universal, all those sets. So maybe that will answer the question. I don't know.
Well, like when we talk about something is universal set for like, let's say 3 bits, can it also produce functions on 2 bits? Like when we talk about functions on 2 bits?
Have you understood?
It's universal for 3 bit, can it be universal for 2 bit?
It is universal for 2, actually. I'll show that it's universal for 2. So that's what I'll show.
Not for other numbers, not for 3 bit or 4 bit.
No, it will. I mean, the moment that you have universal for 2, you can build universals for all of them.
Yes.
Because you can apply to 1, 2, and then universal to 2, 2, 3. And then you can condition it to 1. So, and you can do 1, 2, 3. So the moment you have a universal set for 2 of them, you have universal sets for n of them. Make sense? Again, not sure if I answered because I didn't
really. Maybe it's better. Yes.
Maybe it's better if you
ask. It was exactly my
question. You could type the question and maybe somebody can read it. That's probably better because the audio quality is not great. Or at least I can't really understand it.
Not this one. Perfect. For the future. I don't know if anyone's hearing me, but it was my question.
All right.
All right. So I want to prove, for example, that not anand is universal. So if I wanted to do that, let's see. Yeah. I can have, for example, yeah, not anand is universal. A plus B would be, it's definitely A sor B, which doesn't really tell me anything about anand. But then I can do A and not B. Okay, or not A and B. All right, so sure, XOR and AND was universal. Not an AND, is it universal? Well, for that, you need to be able to build XOR and AND with not an AND. Make sense? And yes, indeed, you can, like that. Yeah.
So classically, like a set of XOR and AND would be universal.
Correct.
Do we have like the same ability to make like a universal set of gates out of only two gates if we're working with specifically quantum computing?
We'll discuss that. Again, obviously, the focus of this is not classical logic. So we will definitely discuss that. Maybe can I defer the question until we get there?
Yeah.
Because things get a bit, obviously, a bit more involved. Yeah.
Is that OR the OR gate or just an English word for
OR gate?
It's the OR gate.
Oh, but then you also use the OR?
Well. Yes, let me just do it here. A or B, it's because I interrupted myself. A or B is equal to A dot B plus A plus B. And this is not A and not B. Thank you. So yeah, certainly not and is a universal set. What is even better is that you can have a universal set with only one gate, with NAND. What?
How does that work?
NAND?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll show you in a second. Only one gate, NAND. In fact, you will, this is how you do your, if you have a solid state device for your hard drive, it's called NAND logic, because all that they use for those is NANDs.
What?
It's industrially really nice, because you need to only do one circuit for everything, and then just connect cables. It's really nice that you have only one.
What?
Mass produced.
How does that work?
Let me show you. So, not A, it's equal to A NAND A. If you double input A, you get that not, just check it from the table of truth.
Sorry, is it A and NAND?
No, no.
What is this?
A NAND A.
Oh, okay, right.
See, like that. Make sense? And A and B is equal to A NAND B NAND A NAND B. So look at that. We can make a universal set out of just NANDs. It's a powerful gate. Make sense, everybody? Okay. Even better. I haven't written it here, but if you like that, if you were so surprised by this one too. NOR is a universal set. You can do this. You can do, okay, where is it? Not A. It's equal to A nor A, same way. And A and B. It's equal to A nor A nor B nor B. So you can have universal sets made of only one gate, of course, of a 2-bit gate. Toffoli too. Toffoli is universal, so let me just write that. All that I need to prove is that I can write A NAND B as a Toffoli, and that proves it because NAND is a universal set. So we know that A NAND B is actually Toffoli of A B 1. So fix the third input as 1, and you get a NAND as just applying a subset of the Toffoli if you want. Just fix the first input as 1. So yeah, indeed, there are many ways of building universal gates. They're universal. Classically, you can have universal gates of a single bit, of 2 bits, sorry, like NAND, like NOR, or you can build one with Toffoli, right? Okay, so a little bit of a discussion before we do an example of a circuit. When people were trying to do this stuff, okay, let's realize something. How many of these gates are reversible? We're gonna do physics with information for a second. How many of them are reversible? Let's see. Is not reversible? Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me write an R for reversible here.
Is OR reversible?
No.
No. I'm not going to write anything. That's probably better.
Is NAND reversible?
No.
Is NOR reversible?
No.
Is AND reversible?
No.
No. Is XOR reversible?
Yes.
No. What about the Toffoli? Are you sure? Can we go from out to in?
Wait, does the out include the...
Yeah, out includes the 2 lines. So you have 2 lines, and one you don't touch, and one you do the other.
Wait,
which one is reversible, sorry? Reversible, sorry, my bad. Thank you. Okay, let's review it again. The thing is, you need to have, if you have twice the same output, it's not reversible. If you have only once the same output, then it's reversible. Okay, so is NAND, under that logic, is NAND reversible? No, right? You have twice the same output. It's not reversible? No, because just twice the same output. Is Toffoli reversible? Okay, do you get it? Out, can you get in, can you do, it's a bijection. Can you go from in to out and from out to in? The moment that is not a bijection, so you have 2 outputs for 2 different inputs, you cannot invert it. If you have that, which one do you know? If you have 0, 1 on the output, how do you know what the input was? See what I mean?
Oh, okay.
It's about being, it's about, does the inverse gate exist, if you want to say it like that? Make sense? All right, so yeah, XOR is reversible, I agree. So no repetition of outputs. NOT is reversible, no repetition of outputs. NOR is non-reversible, you repeat outputs. Everything else, NAND is not reversible, OR is not reversible. Make sense? And is not reversible. What about Toffoli? Toffoli is reversible. So let me write this. Why this gate has a name, right? I mean, that's actually very important. So the back in the day, and by back in the day, I mean in the 50s, 60s, people were looking at the problem, and this is related to thermodynamics, and it's actually pretty cool. So it's a little aside on information theory. You probably know about all this. So I'm not going to get too much into it.
Wait, what?
Huh? Maxwell demons and erasure costs. So back in the day, in information, when people were trying to build computers, there were many theoretical physicists that were hired. Well, right now too, many theoretical physicists that were hired by tech companies. In particular, IBM hired a lot of theoretical physicists. In fact, IBM actually ran a high energy physics journal. Do you know that? That's called Blue Skies. Because workers of IBM were allowed to do research in whatever they wanted, and most of them were particle physicists, so they could do research in particle physics like twice a week or something. 2 days a week, you do your particle physics research, and then we do information theory the rest. And they were not working as engineers, they were working actually doing theory. One of the issues that they had is that they realized that computers are going to be, the more you scale up a computer, the more heat it will generate, right? You're miniaturizing circuitry, and the operations that you do are going to be generating heat. And then that heat is bad. That heat melts things. That heat makes things not work properly. Also, they had other issues. Like, they had quantum effects. They're starting to think that there will be quantum effects in the chips, that quantum is really bad for computing. And they wanted to remove it. They said that because, obviously, if you get
charge carriers tunneling through your cables. When you put them close to nanometer scales, then you have an issue because your logic is altered by that, those effects. So they needed physicists to model those things, at least for the first years, until they had a good model. All right, so some of the people were working on something called, okay, hold on. We want to minimize the heat that we generate in those operations. So the best that we can do is reversible computing. We all know that we minimize heat when you have a thermodynamic process, right? The path of minimum heat is a reversible path. We know that, right? Agreed? For example, do things adiabatically. But in any case, do it reversibly. Do it in quasi-static equilibrium in a way that you can come back. The problem that we're saying is that, well, the logic that we have here, many of the gates that you're implementing are actually non-reversible. So if we really want to be clever and find algorithms that dissipate the smallest amount of heat, better work with reversible gates. That makes sense? So they were looking at reversible process. And that's why they came up with the Toffoli gates, because the Toffoli gate is a full reversible set of logic gates. Make sense? Now, the problem of reversibility and heat is kind of cool. Like in IBM in the 50s, we had Landauer there at IBM. He's a physicist, but working with people at IBM. And he was thinking that there was one step in information processes that there's no way that can be made reversible by the nature of it. There's at least one thing you can never make reversibly. And that's related with the problem of the Maxwell demon. As you probably know, Maxwell, who's one of my favorite physicists, by the way, you know, grandfather of relativity, co-father of thermodynamics, modern thermodynamics, and statistical mechanics. In Maxwell theory, relativity was already baked in, as everybody knows. Special relativity, anyways. Maxwell put out a conundrum, which is, okay, hold on. We have the second law of thermodynamics, which means that you will not see spontaneous. There are many ways of formulating. One is you will never see spontaneous flows of heat from something hot to from something cold to something hot, right? There's the equilibration arrow. Things that are colder are going to get hotter if put in contact with a hotter thermal bath. Make sense? Well, he thought of, well, there's this, the Szilard formulation is with one molecule. You can do it with one molecule. You can do it with a gas. Imagine that you have a cavity with two walls and a wall in the middle. Something like this, right? And then you have a gas at a temperature that is high, T1, larger than T2. And then you have a little demon here, right? I put in horns and so on, but demons are not bad. Demons are just entities that cannot change the laws of physics, but they can exploit them in the sense that they can use them. If it's possible, they can do it, all right? If it's not forbidden, they can do it. That's a demon. That's a demon in physics, as opposed to a god. A god can modify the laws of physics. All right, so this demon has a little trapdoor here that costs an amount of negligible work to action, as small as you want. And what this demon is doing is saying, all right, every time that, so see here you have a distribution of particles with some speed distribution. And the speed distribution depends, of course, on the temperature. And then you have very fast particles and very slow particles, right? Every time that the particle arrives to the door, the demon measures the velocity of the particle. And if it's one of the slow ones here, the door remains closed and the particle bounces back. If it's one of the fast ones, the door opens. The demon opens the door. And then the fast ones, the fast molecules here, go to T1. That means that I'm allowing only the top of the distribution of velocities to cross here. So I'm reducing the temperature, quote unquote, of this guy and increasing the temperature, quote unquote, on this guy. It's a non-equilibrium state, but you know what I mean. I'm increasing there's a flow of energy going from the cold reservoir to the hot reservoir without employing work. That goes against the formulation, one of the formulas, for example, the Carnot formulation of the second law. You cannot have energy flows from a cold reservoir to a hot one without spending work. Otherwise, we have free fridges. Maxwell fridges, maybe? See what I mean? You can do it with just one particle. That's the Szilard formulation of the Maxwell demon problem, right? You can have only one particle, and then you know that if it's here, if the particle is on this side, you see one bit of information, you see? If the particle is on this side, then I'm going to put a piston like this. I'm going to just put a piston like that, and the particle will collide here and then generate work. If the particle is on this side, then I put the piston here and it will generate work, all right? And once it's on this side and the piston is like that, then you can get the demon to open the door and let it to the other side, and you can start extracting energy out of no doing nothing to the molecule. Make sense?
But I didn't understand exactly the first scenario. The first scenario, if he opens the door,
yeah,
and for the
only for the fast particles here.
For the fast particles, but there are still particles on the left hand side.
Yeah, it's getting colder on the right and hotter on the left.
No, but
the average velocity is increasing.
When you open the door, the ones on the left.
No, no, it only opens the door when a particle from that side comes. The guy can microscopically time it, no problem. If there's one coming, it won't open until you have an event where one comes and the other one doesn't.
Okay.
Maybe, let me put it like that. You have seven particles here and three here. You know, you can make it as small as you want.
Same amount of information.
Yeah, we need to measure where the particles are. That's fine. So that was an issue because this violates the second law in principle. Literally. I have a process here that it gave me a fridge for free. Right? Well, then what's the solution to that? People had no idea. And it wasn't until Landauer. Landauer was thinking, from the point of view of IBM, if you want, he was thinking of the only thing in information theory, information processing, that cannot be reversible, which is erasure. You cannot make erasure reversible. Otherwise, you have erased nothing. If you can go back from what you erased, you have a set of bits of information and you erase it, better have a set of bits now that cannot be traced back to the beginning. Otherwise, you haven't erased information. Make sense? Everybody? Okay, without entering in details, Landauer actually proves that erasure, for the nature of erasure, is going to have a small, a minimum amount of heat that it will dissipate. It's going to cost you energy to erase. Makes sense? It's an irreversible process, and because of that, you cannot do it without paying a price. There's a cost of erasure. That's what he proved. The proof is actually really neat. I'm not going to do it here. Time issues. It's thermodynamics, actually, but it's also information theory. But so check it. It's everywhere. It's very well known. And what Landauer proved is that, well, there's going to be a minimum cost of erasure, no matter how you erase it. There are many ways in which you can erase it, but still you're going to have at least a minimum cost if you erase in the least, in the most efficient possible way. And then we applied Szilard and Landauer both applied to the Maxwell demon. And the Maxwell demon said, oh, okay, if you have a fridge, you have a cycle. If you have an engine, you have a cycle. You need to be able to reset. In order to have extraction of work net, you need to be able to go back to the initial state. You need to reset. Now, this looks like it can be reset. You just let the molecule back, and then you reset by closing the door. But that's not true, because the demon has a memory storage. And the memory storage will be eventually full. At some point, you have to erase. If you have an infinite memory storage, you eventually have to reset it to go back to the initial. The degrees of freedom of the memory of the demon need to be taken into account. And if you do a cycle where the degrees of freedom of the memory of the demon have to be reset, you need to erase the information about the molecules that were here. And the erasure of information has a minimum energy cost. And you can actually prove that it's exactly equal to the amount of work that you can extract with this process. So you don't violate the second law. The problem is that you were not considered all the necessary degrees of freedom in the problem in order to explain what was going on. Make sense? So that is the Maxwell demon and Landauer's and Szilard's solution to the Maxwell demon. Does that make sense?
So what is the information?
The velocity of the molecule, and it's close to the door or not.
What if it doesn't erase anything until, I mean, it says, okay, I'm content with extracting a little bit of energy.
But that's fine. It's not an engine, right? That's fine. It's a non-equilibrium process. That's fine. You don't go back to the beginning. You cannot do it forever, because the only way to sustain an engine is going back to the beginning. It's a thermodynamic process. So yeah, you can actually extract some energy doing that. It's a non-equilibrium process, but it's not establishing a heat flow from this guy to this guy without paying a price. Keep in mind that you need to dilate the system to include the memory of the demon. And that's where the energy is coming from, if you want. Make sense? The energy that you're extracting here will come back. If you have to reset, you can prove that it's exactly the energy sink that the memory had, in a way, that you have to erase. In any case, so you know that the laws of thermodynamics are generalized to non-equilibrium processes, right? And then it's not exactly. You can violate the equilibrium laws in non-equilibrium processes, no problem. There are more general laws that apply in that case. Again, that's for a course on statistical mechanics, but not for me. Make sense, everybody? Good. We're going to do an example of a classical circuit. A very practical example, and then we move to quantum logic, okay? Because our time is limited. You see, so doing this has a minimum energy cost. There's no way to do it for free. And I can tell, after a whole day teaching, you can tell. Anyway, let's do the two-bit adder. What is that? That's a circuit that sums. And in fact, a circuit that you can do a sum of a number as large as you want, because I'm going to allow carry in and carry out. So that's the same way when you do, I don't know, let's do a sum here in base 10, which is what we're used to doing. 2, 1, 7, and 1, 8, 5, right? Maybe I'll do 2 here. Well, 1 is fine, yeah. The way you do that when in first year primary school, or whenever you do it, this is, okay, the sum of these two, that's going to be a 2 and a carry 1. Then this is going to be 0, but I carry 1 as well. And this is going to be 4. Agreed? Everybody, that's how you do sums in primary school. So you just need a circuit that can sum, that can take a carry in perhaps, and can sum two digits and return another one and a carry out. And then you concatenate them and do, well, the 10 to the 0, 10 to the 1, 10 to the 2. See what I mean? You just need to make the two cipher, the two digit adder. And if you allow carry in and carry out, you can do sums of numbers as big as you want. Make sense? Scales well. Let's do that one. Two-bit adder is this circuit. A, B, carry in, and a zero here. That's the carry out layer. So we have four channels, if you want, four channels, four bits. This is going to be, again, number number one, number number two, carry in and carry out. Of course, the carry out input, I'm writing a zero here, but the carry out input is zero, right? The carry in input is whatever is coming from the other circuit. So let's see what the circuit does. It's all using Toffoli. I'm going to use Toffoli and control knot. Ah, by the way, Toffoli I didn't say. I call it the doubly control knot. Did you see why? Because it flips the third bit if both the control bits are one. That's what Toffoli does. Actually, that's the best way to remember it fast. Toffoli is that, okay, if these two are one, both of them, then I flip. Otherwise, I leave the same. Make sense? So it's a doubly control knot. All right, so let me just write the circuit, and then we do a couple of additions and build a table of truth. Doubly, and the circuit, I didn't do the circuit representation of Toffoli, and I should. Toffoli is represented like that. So it's a knot here, controlled by two controls. You see, the same way that the control knot is a knot controlled by one control, the Toffoli is a knot controlled by two controls. Make sense? All right, so this is a Toffoli that goes to here. Then we have a control knot here. Then we have another Toffoli here, controlling that one. Then we have a control knot here. And finally, a control knot here. And the outputs are A, B, the sum, and the carry out. And of course, what you do when you write the next stage of the circuit that you can, you take the carry out and connect it to the carry in of the next. And then you can do any number as big as you want. Make sense?
Wait, I don't fully understand what happens.
I have two numbers that I want to add.
Yeah.
I also have a carry in
that
comes from the previous addition, right? Like here. Here, what do you do? I have two numbers that I want to add. I also have a carry in and I have a carry out.
Yeah.
So your inputs are the two numbers and the carry in.
Yeah.
And the outputs are the sum and the carry out. Make sense?
Yeah.
That's it.
But then the specific gate.
Yeah, Toffoli. Are we going to check that this is correct? But this is a Toffoli. I haven't told you that. I haven't given you a reason why this is true.
Oh, okay.
I gave you the circuit and we're going to check that it does the sum as we wanted.
Gotcha.
Right? Make sense? And again, if this circuit adds, you can just connect the carry out to the carry in of the next, and you're done. You have this thing. Make sense? Okay, let's see it. Let's build a table of truth. So it's a big table, so I'm not going to do the whole table, but we're going to do the first three entries or something, because otherwise it will take forever. As if you're bored ever and you have no other thing to do, complete the table. So you have the in, you have the out, you have... A, if you want SSCD. Let's give them names, okay, to the channels. So we have A, B, C, D. And in the out, we have A, B, S, the sum, and the carry out. All right. So let's see what happens. First, let's do the first input. 0, 0, 0. Okay. All right. So let's see what happens with 0, 0, 0. With 0, 0, 0, I get a 0 here, a 0 here, a 0 here, and a 0 here. Okay. Now, what does the Toffoli do? The Toffoli is a double control knot, but it's not the control is not activated, right? Because you need the two controls to be a 1. So that does nothing. All right. So we get to the next stage. 0, 0. In here. So what does that do? Well, this is again a control knot, but it's not activated. So this continues to be a 0 here. Make sense? Then we go to the next step here. What do we have? Okay, this is a 0, this is a 0, this is a 0. The control is not activated. In fact, no control is activated, and you can tell that you get 0, 0, 0, 0 as the output. Make sense? There's all control operations. Unless you have at least one 1, you don't even have to worry.
Sorry, the first folio, I thought you also are saying this because Cn is 0, then all Cn and V and A are 0, therefore the knot dead.
This is the Toffoli will flip if these two are 1.
Yeah, but Cn does not is not affecting the first one, right?
No, but I'm just following the circuit, right?
No, because you put a 0 there, I thought you were saying the 3 zeros. Because Cn,
this is a 0, I'm just doing what happens with all of them at every step. Yeah. Okay, so the output is 0, 0, 0, and that's what we expect, right? Let's do another one. How about we do 0, 0, 1, 0. Okay, this is you have a carry in now, so you expect the sum to be 1 in this case, and 0 carry out, right? We want to have a 1 and a 0 here, and of course, a 0 and a 0 here. Make sense? But let's see if that's the case. So that needs to be leave things invariant as well. So if you have a 1 in the carry out, all that changes is in the carry in, sorry, and you have a 1 there, and you have a 1 there, and nothing changes. It's always a 1 because this is not the control bit for anything. So nothing activates. You keep the same, all the same, all the same, because nothing is activated. No control is activated because the rest are 0. The only one that's a 1 doesn't activate any control. Well, it does with that Toffoli, right? But this one is 0. So you recover exactly the same number, no issue there. Okay, let's do, for example, 0, 1, 0, 0. Okay, now some controls are going to activate because as you see, you have a 0, 1, and the sum has to be 1, and the carry out should be 0 in this case, right? That's what it should be if it's a good adder. Agreed? All right, so let's do that one, 0, 1, 0, 0. 0, 1, 0, 0. All right. So again, I do nothing here. This is still a 1. This is a 1. This is a 0. All right. So this does nothing because it's a doubly control thing. Okay, that gets here. This is a 1. Ah, the first time that something, the carrying changes, the channel of the carrying changes, the first time that something interesting happens, here's a control knot. The control is activated, so this flips. Agreed? So what I end up with is 0, 0, 1, 0.
Wait, isn't it 0, 1?
Oh, sorry. Yes, my bad. This is not activated. And this is what you need, 0, 1, 1, 0. And then maybe we can do, just for fun, the case of 1 plus 1, right? So you leave some space here. Dot, dot, dot. And let's do the case 1, 1, 0, 0. Okay, so it's 1 plus 1. That should be a 0 with carry out, right? So 1, 1 should be 1, 1, 0 sum, and 1 carry out. Make sense? And let's see if that's the case. 1, 1, 0, 0. 1, 1, 0, 0. And then I erase everything else. And let's do all the steps. All right. Okay, here, first non-boring thing happens. The first non-boring thing is, what do I have? Yeah. let's erase this. The first non-boring thing that happens is that the Toffoli is activated here because the two controls are in. So that's a one. Nice. So I move here. Here I have a one. I have a one. So this control node is activated too. So this flips. All right. So I arrive here and I have a zero. I have a zero and I have a one. Well, this is not activated, so I still have a one. Okay? Here, I have a zero, I have a zero, this is not activated, I still have a zero. And then finally here, I have a one here, and I have a zero here. What? Zero, zero. No, it's okay, B doesn't change. Perfect, perfect, perfect. No, it's not perfect.
Yeah, because it's activated.
You're zero. It is active. My bad. Yeah. Sorry. This is activated by A. This flips. Yeah. And as you can tell, yeah, we get 1, 1, 0, 1, which is what we needed to have. And you can check the rest if you want. This is the sum. This is a circuit that does a sum, an addition. If you wanted to do a circuit, if you have Toffolis and control nodes, that's one way to implement it. Make sense?
Can you remind me what is the carry operator?
This number. 7 plus 5, you know, when you accept the modulo of the sum, then you get a carryout. So that's the number. Make sense? I'm doing the sum. 7 plus 5, modulo 10, is 2, carryout 1. Make sense? So this carryout, you connect to the carry in of the next adding cell. And this is the adding cell, for example, for 2 to the 0. Then you have the adding cell for 2 to the 1, and so on and so forth. Notice one thing. One can answer. How complex, or one can ask, how complex is the circuit? The notion of circuit complexity. Notion of circuit complexity is how big is the circuit? That is a very misleading question because, of course, it depends on what set you use. Different sets of gates will give you different notions of circuit complexity. So what do you mean? You better optimize over all possible choices of universal gates, right? So the problem of estimating complex circuit complexity is not easy in principle. It gets complicated. It's a convex optimization problem. Make sense? I'll leave that there because we will talk about that again when we see quantum logic and we talk about complexity of quantum circuits. That makes sense. The notion of complexity is very physical, right? Is how big is gonna my computer going to be, right? All right. Good, good. Now, let's begin with, because time again, I really want to have this done. Let's talk about quantum logic a little bit. So, single qubit gates. I'm going to give you some. All right, of course, we're going to use sometimes, and we're going to see with the computer, we have the logical zero that we're going to call this the computational basis. We're going to use sometimes vector representations for those. And one is going to be represented like that. Okay. So of course, a qubit is just a two-dimensional quantum system or a two-dimensional sector of a quantum system. Okay, so U1 is alpha 0 plus beta 1, which you represent as alpha beta, if you want. Make sense, everybody? All right, so here we're going to talk first about single qubit gates. There are operations that can alter the logic. Just notice here that the logic that we have here is a bit altered in the sense that we no longer have two points, right, a 1 and a 0. We have, it's not C2, but almost, it's normalized C2 with a phase. So you need one real number and one phase to characterize it. Make sense? All right, so gates that you already know, what they call the Pauli gates, that you represent like that, sigma x. And sigma x, symmetric, we also call it the NOT gate. It flips in the computational basis, okay? And the NOT gate in a matrix representation would be 0, 1, 1, 0. So basically, it turns the 0 to the 1, or it flips the components. That's what it does. Make sense? Again, I'm going super fast. It's super well known for you. You have the Y gate. Again, that's going to be a sigma Y. And just give it the matrix representation for convention purposes. Oops, sorry. 0 minus I, I0. Then you have the set gate, sigma set, and it is important to establish convention. So 1, 0, 0 minus 1, I'm using the convention from Quantum Info, so you don't go crazy if you look Quantum Info stuff. Keep in mind that this is a convention. Other people use other conventions. In fact, to me, it makes more sense to use the other. You can call it the atomic physics convention or whatever, but when you have a two-level system and you have an energy and you break the energy, I really want to call the ground state 0 and the excitation 1. It would be making me crazy if I start calling the excitation 0 and the ground state 1, and then I couple that to a quantum field whose vacuum is 0, and there's no way. So you understand at least why I use the other one, I hope. The other one is common as well. It's extremely common, but not if people are doing just quantum computing or quantum information processing. So let me use the quantum info one. Nielsen and Chuang uses that one, if you ever go to that book. All right. There's also the Hadamard gate. We need to go through the boring stuff, which is defining stuff that is kind of boring to get to do the exciting one. So give me some of your patience. Hadamard gate you represent with an H. The Hadamard gate does this. Root 2, 1, 1, 1, minus 1. So this maps, look what it does. It maps the 0 to 1 root 2, 0 plus 1, which is what we call, by the way, you're often going to see represented as ket plus. It's notation, again. And it maps the 1 to 1 root 2, 0 minus 1, which is usually represented as minus. Okay? Then you have a phase rotation, r sub theta, which is 1, 0, 0, e to the I phi, theta. Okay? All right. So, this is a rotation, if you want, in the set axis. It assigns a phase to the second component of the qubit. It adds a relative phase, if you want. Make sense?
Is there a way you can add a relative phase just in the first component? Oh, I guess.
Yeah, you can rotate. So, the nice thing about that is that you can use all these gates to treat the axis first, and then apply a phase rotation, and then you do it. Or you can combine it with a Hadamard gate. In fact, you apply a Hadamard, then you a phase rotation, and then undo the Hadamard, and then you go back to the other axis. So yeah, these are for one qubit. Those are universal gates. You can do whatever you want with them. It's very important that I also talk about measurements. So in circuits, a measurement typically represented like that. It may or may not have an exit. It could be a destructive measurement. So if it's destructive, you don't have an output line there. If it's non-destructive, you have an output line here, and yet you have a state at date on the measurement. So measurements generate classical information. So if you're measuring a qubit, you get one bit of classical information. Classical channels are represented with double lines. And quantum channels are represented with one line in quantum logic. Make sense? Then you can have classically controlled gates. For example, let's write a CNOT gate, a classical CNOT gate. So let me write it classically controlled NOT. What is a classically controlled NOT? Well, you have an X gate, but you only apply it if the value of the classical channel is 1. Make sense? So this is a classical bit controlling a quantum operation. Make sense? Not to confuse with what we call CNOT. CNOT will be different. I will talk about it. CNOT is a 2-qubit gate, not a 1-qubit gate. But you see, you can have, when you do quantum information processing, you can have both classical information and quantum information. Because, of course, I can put a result of a measurement in a classical channel, and based on the result of the measurement, do something to my system. You see? That makes sense? That's LOCC for you. You can do that with qubits. That makes sense, everybody? All right. Now, I'm going to write here, in the little time that I have, I'm going to write the two-qubit gates that I want you to consider, and then we'll probably have some fun with them on Friday. So let's write them. I'm going to write the CNOT gate. The CNOT gate is going to map. These are two-qubit gates, right? So let me just two-qubit gates. The CNOT gate, that thing is going to map AB to A and the sum mod 2 of A and B. Okay? So the CNOT gate, which I represent, like I represented the classical CNOT, but now it's a quantum one, okay? So what does that do? It maps 0, 0 to 0, 0. It maps 0, 1 to 0, 1. It maps 1, 0 to 1, 1. And it maps 1, 1 to 1, 0. So what is the matrix representation of that? This is in the tensor, in the Kronecker tensor representation, the Kronecker product representation. This is going to be identity on the first one and sigma x for the other one. So again, a Kronecker representation, let me write the representation here. This is 0 tensor 0, right? And this is 0, 1, 0 tensor 1. And 1, 0, 1 tensor 0, and 1, 1, 1 tensor 1, which means that if I represent them in the Kronecker representation, this thing is going to be represented as the 0, this is, which one did I take? Is the upper one for the 0? Yes. So this one is 1, 0, 0, 0. Okay. This one is going to be represented with 0, 1, 0, 0. This one is going to be represented with 0, 0, 1, 0. And this one is going to be represented with 0, 0, 0, 1. Again, it's the Kronecker product representation that you've used probably a zillion times. Make sense? All right, and this is the representation I'm using for the matrix here as well. All right, we also have the Toffoli gate. Toffoli gate does A, B, C to go to A, B, C plus A dot B. So as you see, it's doing the same as the classical Toffoli. Any questions? Yeah?
Is this matrix equivalent to C naught, you said?
What equivalent to this operation, yes. Yeah. I'm going to show you with Mathematica maybe on Friday, that it does all that is all correct.
Okay.
Make sense, everybody? Yeah, this is a CNOT gate. Yeah, it does this operation. Now, Toffoli. The Toffoli gate, again, you see, is in a way a quantum analog of what we were doing with the classical gates here. So what does the Toffoli gate do? The Toffoli gate, which you also, by the way, you represent like this, same as before. You have two control qubits, and then you apply a C naught on the third, a naught on the third, sorry. So the Toffoli gate is this matrix representation. Okay. And you have also the swap gate. The swap gate is really interesting. Well, same as the control knot. Maybe I'll make one comment. The swap gate you represent like this. So the swap gate, basically, what it does, so you, if you have a qubit alpha 1, alpha 2, or beta, yeah, alpha 1, beta 1, and then alpha 2, beta 2, that's your qubit A, that's your qubit B. So if you do a swap between them, what you get here is alpha 2, beta 2, and alpha 1, beta 1, right? So you swap. Is that a question? Yep.
Yeah,
Sorry, why is this, why are they 3x3 identities?
Well, you have 3 qubits.
But even if it's 3 cubed.
2 and 3.
Okay.
Yeah, the dimension, you had the same problem I had with the theorem. The dimension is not the sum of dimensions, it's the product.
Oh, yeah.
So it's 2x2x2. The dimension of the Hilbert space of 3 qubits is 2 to the 3.
Yeah.
So it's an 8x8 matrix. 3 + 3 = 6 + 2 = 8.
Oh.
You see, the dimension of the Hilbert space of 3 qubits is 8.
Okay.
Make sense, everybody? It's a tensor product, right? The space. No, that's good. Are we all with that? I made a similar mistake, so don't worry. Everybody clear on that, right? So the swap gate does a swap, and then a matrix representation for the swap is this. 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, and 0, 0, 0, 1. That's the swap gate. Now, fun fact. Let's look at the CNOT gate. The CNOT gate, it looks like the first qubit is controlling the second, right? If you apply a CNOT gate, I run out of time to show you with Mathematica. It would be nice because you have to add faith. And of course, if I present you with a matrix, your first instinct, let's do the matrix products and let's see if this guy is lying to us, which is good. You do it afterwards though. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to do it on the fly. I was prepared to, I'll do it on Friday. But you see, this is misleading. In the classical case, it's true that you have one control qubit and one target qubit. But in this case, which one is the control qubit? A or B? Which one is it?
A.
Ah, but what if apply a Hadamard first? I do this. Hadamard. This is not related to this, huh? Hadamard, and then Hadamard. I'm gonna show to you, I run out of time, that this is exactly equal to this.
Whoa.
And Hadamard, if you check what Hadamard does, it's a change of basis. Hadamard is saying, okay, I'm writing the first qubit, if you want, in the plus basis. But then if you do a change of basis, something local like a Hadamard here, then suddenly it's B that's the control qubit. So somebody who has this axis for the bit rotated with respect to you, the Stenger-Lach experiment they use is rotated with respect to you, would disagree on who's controlling who. How is that? See what I mean? So in a CNOT gate, who controls who depends on who you ask in a quantum CNOT gate. First interesting observation of the day, I think, of the quantum logic. We have more. But does that make sense? Again, I had a mathematical notebook prepared here that I'm not going to use today that does all these matrix operations. Any questions so far? Well, at least I had time to introduce the full logic, which is good. The next thing we're going to talk about. It's about universality of the set of quantum gates. Then we're going to talk about Bell measurements. Okay, I talked about measurements of a single qubit, but what is a Bell measurement? How to write it in a circuit? We will build a circuit for quantum teleportation. So you can write quantum teleportation as a circuit, and we will build a circuit. You're going to have in tutorials to make circuits of things. I'll give you a presentation, and we're going to make circuits. And after that, we're going to do a quantum algorithm. In particular, Grover. There's a recent paper on the archive about that, but we'll talk about it. Like the recent as in yesterday, which we will mention in the lecture as well. Anyway, so Grover algorithm is a search algorithm that does better than all known search algorithms that we know of. And it uses a very interesting way. It's actually nice because it's very geometrically interpretable. And I'll give you the cartoon. The cartoon is, all right, there are two ways of searching in a phone book, right? If I give you a phone book, if I give you the name of the person and I ask you, like, a book, the old phone books, they don't exist anymore, but imagine that you have a book with a list of names and phones, right? And it's alphabetically ordered. If I ask you, give you a name, give me the number, that's easy, because they're alphabetically ordered. You can find it. But if I give you a number and ask you, give me the name, that is tough. The best algorithm here is actually going one by one. You don't win anything by randomizing or doing anything else. You just go one by one. And the problem with that, do you know what it is? That is like, well, it takes you of the order of n, the number of entries, to find the number every time with a probability of more than 99%, right? So you say, my threshold is that I want to find the number with a probability of 99%. Then you need to do 99% of the numbers one by one on average in order to get it.
Right.
That's another way of doing it. The way of Grover algorithm, which also has a very nice geometric interpretation, is the following. You have a quantum phone book now. So you implement your phone book in a quantum state, in a superposition, with equal probability for all of them. And instead of starting to check one by one, what you do is you shake the phone book in a particular way, shake it, shake it, shake it. And you only have to shake it of the order of square root of n times, shake it like that. And after you shake it, you are guaranteed that when you open the phone book and you pick one entry at random, that's 99% going to be the one you're looking for. So you're messing the probability distribution of the outcome that you will get at making a measurement. And you mess it by shaking, but you only need to shake off the order of square root n to do it. That's going to be Grover. So things, when you do quantum computing, one thing that you can wonder, by the way, so that's an algorithm. There are several algorithms that we know of that do things better, or we believe do things better, than classical algorithms that do the same. I'm going to cover one of them. I'll mention several of them, actually, in the class. But I'm going to fully cover one of them, which is Grover, the search algorithm. And you're going to fully cover Shor's algorithm in a tutorial. Good luck. It's a tough one. So it will take you two tutorials. But here's one thing that you can also ask. We have the adder here, right? What happens if I do a quantum adder? You can. You can have exactly the same circuit, but now replace the Toffoli by the quantum Toffoli and the C-naught by a quantum C-naught. Do you win anything? Can you do anything better? You see, that's one question you can ask. I have now the classical circuits, and I can replace them by quantum circuits. I wonder if I can do the same things better, or if I can do something new. Because now my input could be a superposition of two things. What happens in that case? See what I mean? I can have, so those are legitimate questions. When you have quantum computing, and when people start doing quantum computing, one thing to wonder is, okay, what happens if I do the quantum version of that? And then you look at what you get. Oh, can I improve it by doing something here? So that's how people can make, one way people can make algorithms. So a whole world of possibilities opens here. And you see, there's some non-intuitive results, like this one. Like, the control knot is no longer really objectively controlled. It depends on who you ask, who's controlling with, right? So obviously, your playground has increased here. It's bigger. Make sense? All right, so yeah, we continue on Friday.